Are your school days out of sight when you took English, art, and math? What's your favorite Fahrenheit? How sour are the grapes of wrath? Do you need a challenger or disgusting Salinger? Do you love the written word? What happened to the mockingbird? Our show is just beginning, so find a place to sit. These questions will be on the test. It's time for Sophomore Lit.
Welcome back to Sophomore Lit, where we reread your high school reading list. I'm John McCoy, and with me is returning co-host Glenn Fleischman.
Hello. Glad to be back.
Hey, Glenn. Good to have you back. Glenn was, of course, on Moby Dick, the longest episode of this podcast we've had. I think in the intervening time, I've gotten a little bit better at keeping things moving. So this probably won't be as long, but it could be. It could be very well, because we're talking about Mary Shelley's Frankenstein on this podcast. But first, Glenn, tell everyone again who you are and where they've heard you.
Well, I'm a longtime incomparable podcast person. I'm a technology journalist. I spent last year printing a letterpress book because I like living in the 19th century, except for the medicine part. Medicine part bad, as we can discuss with Mary Shelley's family history. Medicine was not so good in the 19th century, but printing was really cool. So that's the part I choose to focus on. I hosted a podcast a few years ago called The New Disruptors about how people do things for themselves, find audiences, and disintermediate and all that jazz.
Now, you came to me with Frankenstein, but this is a book that I think I've had dozens of people asking for. It is a book that gets taught a lot in high school. I guess I've been a little bit hands-off on it because I feel like it's a book that gets covered a lot. So we'll see if we can find something new to talk about this time.
One of the interesting things about talking about it right now is that an amazing new annotated edition is out by Leslie Klinger, who's known as a Sherlock Holmes scholar. He's an attorney, but is one of the preeminent Sherlock Holmes scholars of our age and has an extraordinary, I do not actually own his Sherlock Holmes annotated. It's so big, I haven't yet dared to buy it until I can read it. But last year he came out with this Frankenstein annotation, and he's a great collaborationist. Like, he likes to work with other people, and he's clearly very generous with other people. So this is an amazing book that he produced. It has incredible context. It really helps you understand the text. And we can talk about different texts, but it's also, it is building on and acknowledging all the work of previous annotated versions that had different approaches. So I think it's actually a great time to talk about Frankenstein because we have a new resource to consult with it. So that's a hook. How about that? new Frankenstein, new 2017 Frankenstein. I read this in high school, and I know I've read it a few times since. I have a copy sitting on a shelf, and here's the problem with age. This actually came up in a recent Incomparable episode about Ursula K. Le Guin, where several of us had read Ursula K. Le Guin's books before, and we all realized we'd forgotten most of the details. And rereading Frankenstein, I thought I remembered the story in great particularity, and as I read it, I realized I feel like I'd forgotten most of it. But I remembered, main themes, certainly, and the flow of action, most of it, the significant scenes, the animation, and so forth. But I had actually forgotten way too much of this book. So I'm really glad to have reread it and remembered kind of the core of what it's about. It's got a lot of interesting ideas, and it's a lot of things that drive horror, fantasy, and science fiction. Like, she didn't invent any of those things per se, but holy cow, are there ideas that only appear here first. And as someone wrote, I forget, there's an afterword, I think, in which in this edition I have, notes that this is the first time you have a created being who wasn't created by a god or the god, right? And this is the first time man creates another living creature in literature that has an animating force and a soul. So we can talk about the golem and so forth later. And that's really profound too. So I'm really glad to have reinvestigated the text, having thought that I remembered it and now realized how poorly I did, and now I do again.
You know, I read this in high school at a time when I thought I needed to read a bunch of formative horror texts. I did not read this in the context of a class, but I did read it a few years later in college in an edition. At that time in the mid-80s, there was a real flowering of interest in Frankenstein as a feminist book. That the interpretations of this book are all over the place. If you go through the history of this book, you will find everyone interpreting it one way or another. I'd like to add to the moment that we're at right now, there was an excellent essay in The New Yorker. A co-host of Sophomore Lit, Shannon Camp, sent this around our Facebook group. The New Yorker had a piece by Jill Lepore, who is a great historian, writes for The New Yorker quite frequently, and whom I was fortunate enough to have as a boss for a short time when I worked on her website.
Oh.
She wrote a really entertaining introduction to Frankenstein, outlining the ways in which it has been interpreted, and makes a strong case for interpreting it through the eyes of motherhood. So everyone look that up. And The New Yorker was just, I think, a few months ago.
Oh, yeah. I think this was actually the spur that got me to buy the, I didn't realize Klinger had this book out, even though I like his work. And reading this essay, she mentions Leslie Klinger has this amazing new hardcover annotated version you should get. And I'm like, oh, I will get that and read that. And so this was good insight as well to my process.
Okay. So I'm going to hazard a brief summary here. I think most people out there know Frankenstein, but you know, if you have not read Frankenstein, the main thing to understand is the book is not the movie, the James Whale movie that everyone has in mind when they think of Frankenstein's monster. The book is not even the book, because the book exists in two major editions, the original edition of 1818 and the edition of 1831. Now, I read the 1831 revision, and you?
I read there's actually four versions. Although there are two primary published versions, and then there's also the long history, not to get too in the weeds of text, but after 1831, there are lots of samizdat editions, and then when it goes out of copyright, we don't know the integrity of the text that people are reading. So it's possible that some, you know, I assume Signet Classics and some of the other versions are probably very accurate to one of those earlier texts, but it's also possible if you read Frankenstein, you read a version that was a pastiche or some kind of adaptation or who knows what as well. There was a draft she wrote of which notes survive. So the Klinger version cites some stuff from the draft. The main text of the Klinger annotated Frankenstein is the 1818, but he also footnotes every place in which the 1831 version changed it. So I actually read this. I tried to read this as crisply as the 1818 throughout, but I would consult the notes to understand what had changed. And there is also an interpolated version that she marked up extensively and gave to a friend that has some revisions that made it into 1831 and some that did not. And he includes some of those notes. So at some level, this book is a little bit of a slog if you're trying to get through the annotated version, if you're just trying to get through, because you're reading sort of four texts at once. So I really tried to focus on the 1818, but I think we can talk about the differences there as well.
The book opens with the framing device of Captain Walton, who is writing to his sister. He's on an exploration of the North Pole when he comes across the starving and nearly frozen Victor Frankenstein, who's our titular hero. Although he's almost dead, Victor has enough strength to relay several hundred pages of narrative about his life, including his childhood in Italy and Switzerland, his brother, and his adopted sister, Elizabeth. Now, this is a major change from the 1818 edition to the 1831. In the 1818 edition, Elizabeth was his cousin. But anyway, his adopted sister, we'll say, Elizabeth, who is going to be his wife eventually, because that's just the way the Frankensteins roll. After the death of his mother by scarlet fever, Frankenstein becomes obsessed with discovering the secrets of animation. in his studies at the University of Ingolstadt, including studying things like alchemy and occult and outdated books. He eventually produces a humanoid creature of monstrous proportions because a normal-sized creature would be too fussy. Upon animating the yellow, translucent-skinned creature, he decides he wants nothing to do with it and wanders off to meet his childhood pal Henry. The monster goes missing. Henry coaxes Victor out of his funk, but oh no, Victor's little brother William is killed back in Geneva. His nanny Justine stands accused when Henry's locket is found in her pocket. Victor believes that his creature is somehow responsible, but can't prevent Justine from being hanged. In the Swiss mountains, Victor finds his monster, who has a lot to say for himself. In the next half dozen chapters, he explains how he learned to speak, how he learned to read.
I love the structure. It's so great. We're like in letters, then we have someone's tale being recounted, then we're now the tale being recounted of the creature by Frankenstein, all in quotation marks in those chapters. We're down several levels here.
Yes, exactly. And she's pretty good at keeping track of it.
Yeah.
She pops back up the stack, to use a computer science metaphor. Anyway, the monster explains that he's learned all of these skills of being a human by watching a family of poor cottagers before eventually he is rejected by said family and seeks his revenge on all of humanity by throttling Victor's younger brother, William. The monster thinks, however, that they should let bygones be bygones and Victor should make him a wife. Victor agrees at first, heading to England and then to the Orkney Islands to a new secret lab, but then decides it might not be the best idea and destroys the monster's half-completed bride. The monster then kills Victor's friend Henry, which leads to Victor's brief imprisonment in Ireland, but Victor beats the rap and heads back to Geneva to get married, which is not a smart plan, considering he has the creature on his tail, and the creature offs Elizabeth. Frankenstein's dad also dies for good measure, and Frankenstein vows to chase the monster to the ends of the earth, which happens to be the North Pole by way of Russia. Having heard all this, Walton decides that he's got to turn his ship around or face a mutiny. Victor spends his final days editing the manuscript of his story and finally dies. Uh-oh, the creature has been stowing away and appears by Frankenstein's bed. He's not happy, though, and tells Walton he's heading off to die himself, ice flow style.
That's a really great summary. Good work.
Well, thank you. So you know, this time reading through, I completely forgot how long the creature's story was. Upon revealing himself to Victor in the mountains, they sit beside a fire, and supposedly Victor is in terror of his life, but instead we get, I don't know, several tens of thousands of words from the monster about everything, about how he learned to write, to what his opinions are of religion, to the sad story of these cottagers and their convoluted origins and why they ended up in where they were.
Yeah, they're like a little play inside a play going on, yeah, too. He's watching them through a tiny crack as if they're for his entertainment, sort of, but as teachers, as protectors, he thinks of them.
And the other thing that I guess I left out here is that at one point, the monster discovers a satchel full of books, including an edition of, yeah, Paradise Lost.
Yeah. And The Sorrows of Young Werther, too, of course, has to be.
This is very thematically important. The original edition, the 1818 edition, has an epigram from Paradise Lost, which I think got omitted from the 1831 edition.
Did I request thee, maker, from my clay to mold me man? Did I solicit thee from darkness to promote me? What a thing. What a thing. Call me into existence.
So what were the things that struck you most on this rereading? I mean, you said that you thought you knew this book very well, but you were surprised.
Yeah, I did remember most of the major, let's say, plot points and some of the specific scenes quite well. And this is actually going to become a running joke, I think, on The Incomparable at Large is we were talking in the Ursula Le Guin episode about Left Hand of Darkness, where there's this very long scene on this ice sheet way above on this planet, and they spent a long time getting across it. And we talked about all of the sci-fi and fantasy novels that have long scenes in which people are crossing ice for long periods of time or traveling and camping, like in Lord of the Rings. And then I read this and I'm like, oh, this is the source from which that derives as well. The long scenes in the Arctic ice fleeing. Okay. So now we know where that comes from. I had completely forgotten that the creature demands a bride. I completely omitted the whole English and Irish excursion from my mind. And it's partly, I think, because I had confused that, thinking that was actually a movie invention, like Bride of Frankenstein, not part of the original narrative. And it's so funny. It's very critical, to it. I did not recall, and this may be because I'd probably read the 1831 edition before, and this is one of the big differences in the text. I had not thought of Frankenstein, the creator, as being so neglectful. He continuously avoids taking responsibility for his actions. And so he's done something that's unbelievable. It's, you know, fantastic. And he only convinces a handful of people, maybe only a couple, that he's actually done this, that he's created life. And one of the themes that runs throughout the annotated edition is how much writing there's been about whether Frankenstein's creature is real, whether this is really, he invents the creature. At the end, Walton, the captain, sees the creature as the only other person who has any direct communication where the creature isn't relaying that story to to Frankenstein himself. So there's that aspect as well. And if you read it with that light, you're like, maybe, but then at the end, you get that moment of reality. So as long as Walton is a reliable narrator, which we're sort of assuming he is, he seems very reliable and not fantastic, then we have to assume the monster is real. I did remember there's the whole, his obsession with discovering the animation, that sort of spark of life, and then bringing it and then immediately regretting it, but then essentially abrogating all of his responsibility. In the 1831 edition, I think the primary change is argued that, that Frankenstein, once he creates the monster, is sort of a victim of circumstance, that everything at that point is happening to him and that it's inevitable. There's nothing he could do to change anything. Where in the 1818 edition, he continually is faced with decisions and fails to make the right ones. So he's more of a moral actor. And one of the arguments is that Mary Shelley's life was so horrible that so many people around her, you know, a mother died when she was a child, you know, when she was very young, and her husband and Lord Byron and her three of her four children and all their friends and like this endless litany of deaths all around her. Percy Bysshe Shelley's, his ex-wife that he left to be with Mary Shelley. I think she committed suicide. So there's the issue that between the first and second edition, she may have decided that life is just, it's a thing that happens to you. And, she in her 1831 introduction makes the case that she's not changing very much at all. That she doesn't see these as major changes, but when you look at the passages that are different, there's definitely a thematic change about being, you know, tossed around, which I don't think is as true to the novel as it could be. The 1818 one feels more direct. This is a man who took action. He did a thing and he refuses to acknowledge the consequences and he is being battered again and again for it, as opposed to someone who, once having, you know, tried this creative act and it made it kind of an abortion essentially of it, he then runs away, but it pursues him endlessly.
Now, you mentioned the 1831 preface. That's another major change between the books. The first edition didn't have a preface, right?
It wasn't even, did not have her name on it. Yeah, it was thought that it was written by Shelley, I think was the idea. And then Shelley wrote a review of it as a sock puppet. He did have a lot. Maybe we should address that too, is that there was, this is one of the calumnies against Mary Shelley, is that she didn't write the book. Right. And there's evidence they have access to, you know, parts of the draft. She worked closely with Shelley Percy on revising it. And he did have input. And in the annotated edition, there's even areas marked where, you know, this sentence was added by Percy in the draft. So, you know, and it's all kind of, it's sort of the most highfalutin and least interesting parts of the book are the things that are known to be written in his hand and added. But she wrote this. And she collaborated with him to improve it. But when it came out, it was thought to be by him.
Right. And one of the things when you read the preface is Mary Shelley, in her preface, is trying to make some moral points about this novel, about what this novel means and what it doesn't mean. The thing that this reminds me of, this new preface, it reminds me of the preface that was written by Charlotte Bronte for Jane Eyre, which also seeks to assure the reader that this book, which deals with wickedness, is nonetheless a moral book. So it's an interesting way of predisposing the reader, particularly since Frankenstein is like a lot of 19th century novels in that it creates this elaborate fantasy about how the manuscript gets into your hands in the first place. You know, it's not just a story related by Victor Frankenstein. It's got to have this whole framing narrative within another framing narrative within another framing narrative. That's very common in novels from their beginnings in the 18th century into the 19th century, to always have to have some sort of a device for why we even have this story to begin with. But the preface belies that. The preface marks this as a work of fiction and gives us someone to point to as the maker of this.
Yeah, I think I'm forgetting when did the English novel first come into being? Because it's not the 1700s. Now I'm having a brain fart about that. It's the
People like to point to like Defoe as the first novel, but it really depends upon how you define a novel. I think Robinson Crusoe gets the nod quite frequently for that. But what makes a novel instead right. of what came before, I know it's probably beyond the scope of this podcast. We can get into it sometime.
Well, but it's still a form that's being developed. So 1818, it's not a new form.
Right.
Pamela, let's say, Pamela is an epistolary novel. That's 80 years old at that point. And right. so people are familiar, people have had generations to understand what that kind of structure is. And yet they still turn to the epistolary. They turn to that, as you say, trying to create these elaborate framing mechanisms as if to convince the reader that a thing is real when there's no necessity of it. They do a lot of, waving of hands to bring you into a space. I mean, that's a Shakespearean thing too. There's those Shakespeare plays that have framing mechanisms for no apparent reason. Apparently it's like, is it not artificial enough that we're sitting here watching you on a stage? I guess you want to then try to convince us of something that is not. And it feels like this is the same thing in novel form. I do like the end. I should point out the end of her 1831 introduction is I just love this line. So after all that she said, that as you discussed, she says, and now once again, I bid my hideous progeny go forth and prosper. I have an affection for it, for it was the offspring of happy days when death and grief were but words which found no true echo in my heart. And you're like, oh my goodness. Well, that's a little bit of that, yes, it's a moral novel and it's a story and blah, 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 and go forth my hideous progeny and prosper.
You know, what's amazing to me about this is 1818 and Pride and Prejudice was 1813.
Exactly. Different worlds.
Completely different approach. Completely different worlds. This is so much a novel of the previous century. I mean, it's a 19th century novel, but it really feels like an 18th century novel. It feels like a gothic romance, and this is exactly the sort of thing that Austen came along and utterly displaced.
Mm-hmm.
But it still had a life to it, and it still continued. It's informative, I suppose, that it found this sensibility found its home in works of terror, and you still get other Victorian novels late in the 19th century written with this kind of sentimentality and this kind of overwrought style.
Soon after my arrival in the hovel, I discovered some papers in the pocket of the dress which I had taken from your laboratory. At first I had neglected them, but now that I was able to decipher the characters in which they were written, I began to study them with diligence. It was your journal of the 4 months that preceded my creation. You minutely described in these papers every step you took in the progress of your work. This history was mingled with accounts of domestic occurrences. You doubtless recollect these papers. Here they are. Everything is related in them which bears reference to my accursed origin. The whole detail of that series of disgusting circumstances which produced it is set in view. The minutest description of my odious and loathsome person is given in language which painted your own horrors and rendered mine indelible. I sickened as I read. Hateful day when I received life, I exclaimed in agony. Accursed creator, why did you form a monster so hideous that even you turned from me in disgust? God in pity made man beautiful and alluring after his own image, but my form is a filthy type of yours, more horrid even from the very resemblance. Satan had his companions, fellow devils, to admire and encourage him. But I am solitary and abhorred.
Yeah, the prose is a little purple in places. There's not a lot of what feels like emotional honesty in it. There's a distancing from what it's people writing about a sensibility they experience and presenting it as truth as opposed to emotional truth. And we see emotional truth. That's what's so shocking about Austin, is even though she's using language that is stilted by today's standards and maybe, you know, by contemporary standards, the way people spoke in the time outside of certain classes, it still can speak. And when Mr. Darcy is unspeakably rude or Emma is unspeakably rude, you feel it. And it's a thing. It's not like, oh my goodness. It's like, no, that is really, wow, that's a real emotion, or the love and so forth. Even if it's a little, you know, again, stilted, it still has that resonance. This book is very distanced. It's a kind of intellectual, but it also is chilling. The things that happen are so ghastly and outside of, you know, nature and experience and religion, that I think it breaks through that reserve. So even though Frankenstein is constantly falling into a 3-month fever from which he can't escape, or making strange facial expressions that people can't interpret because he's out of his mind, or people expressing, you know, his cousin, adopted sister, waiting for him for a number of years, just kind of, all right, whenever you're ready, I still love you. You might've fallen in love with someone else. That's fine. But I'm here, so go off to England for 2 years with Henry, I guess. Should also point out, this is, I'd forgotten the time span. He is only 28, I think, when he dies. He's 22 when he goes off to Ingolstadt. Is it Ingolstadt? Ingelheim? When he goes off. There's a timeline. The annotated book is great because it's got various appendices, and one of them is that very funny timeline where you're like, because as I got to the end, I thought, he can't be that old. Yeah. So he's born in 1772 by the chronology, of the appendix. And he dies in 1799. Ingolstadt. Yeah. So he goes off in 1789. What does that make him? Sorry. 17. He goes off to Ingolstadt. He makes the creature a couple, 4 years after that when he's 21-ish. And then he's dead by, age 27. And you think of Frankenstein as, you know, again, because of the popular depiction, I knew he'd started this when he was young, but I'd forgotten that it's all in the bloom of youth, that this happens very quickly.
I was shocked reading it through this time how very little description was given to the manner in which the creature was actually constructed.
Oh, this I remembered very closely. And I had actually looked it up for an unrelated reason. I was trying to remember the text a few weeks ago, before we discussed reading it. And, I love the fact that it is so very vague, that there's no, we don't know exactly what happened. We have all these pictures, again, because of the popular culture. We think there's electricity and we think there's mechanisms, but the whole description of him, he spends 4 months assembling what sounds like random body parts and flesh. And it's not just, you know, A, how did he keep it from being corrupted? Well, I mean, we start with, he goes to charnel houses and mortuaries and things, and he spends a long time just watching stuff decay. And then he's like, oh, that's how life started. Okay, well, now I can make some. And he said, I don't know why anybody else hasn't ever come up with this, which is one of those signs of genius, right? He said, I pause examining and analyzing all the minutiae of causation as exemplified in the change from life to death and death to life, talking about like maggots and things like that, until from the midst of this darkness, a sudden light broke in upon me, a light so brilliant and wondrous, yet so simple that while I became dizzy with the immensity of the prospect which it illustrated, I was surprised that among so many men of genius who had directed their inquiries towards the same science, that I alone should be reserved to discover so astonishing a secret. And there you go. That's all you need to know. That's how you make life, apparently.
Forgive me if I'm wrong about this, but we're told he discovers the secret of life by examining decaying bodies. We're not told that he necessarily makes use of those bodies to create the creature.
It's obscure because it describes him, collecting material. And he's going to both animal, so there's like a combination of things. He's going to places that are both where human bodies are rendered or whatever. And he is also going to charnel houses that have just animal parts. So the question is, like, what is the monster made of? Did he like pulverize bone and pour it into forms to create bigger bones? Did he take sinews and muscles? Did he create something entirely, did he use the process? I mean, that's as a old, not alchemy, I think it predates that, but like spontaneous generation and creation where you mix certain ingredients of life and it will create new kinds of things. They just grow or form spontaneously. And he doesn't mention that, but that's part of that whole sequence of things. So it's really unclear. Right. And as you mentioned earlier, he's working at this giant scale. He's making a creature 8 foot tall. Like this is what's great about how monstrous it is that is not just from the movies. That he literally says, I made this creature 8 feet tall. It's easier to work because the fiddly bits are not as fiddly. They're bigger. You're like, well, what fiddly bits? Are you making capillaries? I don't totally understand here. It's an obscure thing. And you're like, did he take like horse legs? Did he take pig parts? Like what? And we don't know anything about the brain. I mean, at that time, I don't believe, my recollection is the understanding that the brain controlled cognitive function, really comes much later than the early 1800s, doesn't it? I don't think that's so at that point, there wouldn't have been the same notion, of that. And so there's indications later that the monster is remembering things. The text doesn't say he remembers, but if you look at what he learns, it's like at one point he learns from listening to people talk how to read, which is impossible. And so there's the suggestion, this is in some of the annotation and references, that perhaps he had a French speaking brain before, and which is not unusual. He's in, Ingolstadt isn't not really that strange, or I don't know what, but we don't know what parts were used. So perhaps he was actually remembering, and there's aspects of the monster's life that he's not remembering sequences. I mean, this is such a wonderful thing that reverberates later. There's a great episode of Star Trek Voyager, of all things, in which, spoilers for those who have never watched Voyager, this Starfleet character is killed, and I think her body is left behind. I forget if they leave her on a planet or something, or forget the issue, why she isn't with them. And there's a race in the Delta Quadrant where this ship is stuck that essentially revivifies corpses of other species and gives them essentially a new life. And they use a process where they forget. So they don't remember their previous life, but they don't actually make their own bodies. They don't have reproduction, which is a fascinating idea. It's very much this book, right? And this person, she starts to remember her former life, but she's not really the same person anymore. She comes back to the ship. There's a whole fight. And ultimately she realizes that her new life is the true life, that her old life is not who, which is, it's a tragic episode, but it's completely echoed here. We just don't know to what extent the creature is some continuation of a past life, or as Frankenstein thinks, is totally de novo existence.
There was at the time an enormous amount of anxiety in popular culture around the subject of galvanism, which was the discovery that electrical currents can cause muscle spasms in the limbs of animals and people. There, if you look up the subject of galvanism online, there's an amazing mid-19th century cartoon about a galvanized corpse in which two devils are discussing whether or not this reanimated corpse represents a lost soul at that point, whether if you reanimate the body, does the soul go with it? This is pre-Victorian, but the 19th century and then on into the Victorian era, today we think of it as very quaint and we tend to dwell upon social mores. The Victorians thought of themselves as extremely scientific, and the 19th century saw, especially in England, they saw themselves as moving towards a purely reasonable and scientific world. And the question of where traditional ideas about soul and afterlife fit into this new materialistic worldview were very much on everyone's mind. So that certainly would inform what Shelley was writing about, but it makes it all the more remarkable that there is no throw the switch moment in this book.
Yeah.
There's no moment of animation. What we get instead is the moment right after Frankenstein recognizes the spark of life in his creature.
Yeah, this is the moment. Here it is. I collected the instruments of life around me that I might infuse a spark of being into the lifeless thing that lay at my feet. And that's it. And then it comes back to life. That's all we know. And then later in the book, by the way, you know, everyone's hectoring him when he talks about, how did you do this? How did you do this? Walton is trying to get it out of him. He's like, look, didn't you just listen to what story I told? No one should create this again. I'm not going to tell you. This also reminds me, as you spoke of that too, of, this is a little bit later, but Edgar Allan Poe, The Facts in the Case of Monsieur Valdemar, where he, it's not precisely, galvanism, but it's they hypnotize a man who's near death, using magnetic hypnotism, mesmerism, and he's kept in a state of not being quite dead for months until they ask him whether they want, it's so terrible, is, do you want to be put back to, they wake him to speak with him, and he shouts, this dead man shouts, dead, dead, and they bring him out of his trance, and the entire body goes into putrescence in one moment. And I thought, this is the same thing. It's like the willpower. It's this desire of man to conquer, to be a god, to conquer death, to reverse putrescence and decay through some kind of sheer scientific force that is inexplicable, but some have mastered. It's a battle. It's a battle.
Let's talk a little bit about the process by which the creature comes to understand his world, gets explained in great detail, and it is through simple observation. He learns everything about the world via proxy, by watching other people teach language. He watches the language lessons in his family. Eventually, he comes across this copy of Paradise Lost and other, what was the other book that he was that?
It's the Sorrows of Young Werther. And,
right.
There's another one. Yeah, he gets like three books or something. And of course, it's the perfect three books.
As much as I make fun of this book for having these long segments in which characters who are ostensibly in distress or close to death are nonetheless relaying long stories. And then we're told at the very end of the novel that Frankenstein, although he's just exhausted himself explaining the horrors of his life to Walton, he nonetheless spends the next few weeks helping him edit his memoirs.
That's the best thing. It's a reliable narrator, but we know that the version we're reading is an edited version that's been dictated, and then it's sort of a hilarious commentary on the text. It's like an interesting metatextual revelation at the end. Well, I mean, a metatextual, but some kind of like extratextual revelation at the end.
It's a window into a world in which the writ word is the primary mode of meaning and of discovery. Mary Shelley is writing as a writer and as a commentator on Milton and a participant in this world of poetry and ideas. This is the world that she can partake in. You know, and I think that's, I think it's, there's something about this that's very touching to me, that this is a book of, that even in the midst of this, the horrors of this book, this is a book about language and the power of language, and particularly the power of language in a pre-mass media world.
I was also going to say it's the horror of a writer needing to edit themselves so compulsively that they're writing about editing the book they're actually writing, which then they're editing with the help of an editor, which is Percy Shelley, working on it. It's, there's no question that all the turtles are stacked up there. But yes, I agree with you that it's a book in part about the, I mean, this is what animates Frankenstein's creature. It's her words, right? We don't know. Right. There is no mechanism. And so this is a lot of, fiat lux. And we know we should rewind and talk about the golem briefly, because that's probably, I think there are other animation myths before that, but that's one that has no true historical basis, but it's all mythology. Is, the rabbi of, was it Lutz, creates a creature out of clay and animates him with the word of God put on his forehead, and you know, he serves the rabbi, but there's no soul. It's just a, you know, automaton. So at some level, Frankenstein's creature is a tremendous improvement on that, or is it? Because it has ostensibly has free will. He's imbued it with a soul, and there's different references through the book about what kind of soul he's imbued it with, but the soul would be the word, right? This is a written work, and thus the creature itself is a either perfect or imperfect by how well Mary Shelley is able to write the creature as a moral being or not. So we can have that kind of little golem reference too. I want to talk about the family too, because as we talked, you know, we have the captain, and she manages these narratives very well. We never lose the framing thing. We have the captain writing letters to his poor sister who is worried about him. The captain is not a great psychological specimen either. Seems to be very much wants a friend. He just like a friend, and he doesn't have one. And then Frankenstein shows up. This guy can be my friend, except he's cursed and is dying, and also says he doesn't want to be my friend. Anyway, besides that, he has a great story. And so, but in the narrative, we get to the creature describing then, you know, his tale and talking about this family. That family is an immoral family. Let me tell you, like, I have issues with them. And I remember the family at the core. And I remembered on previous readings that they'd had hardship and that he had watched them and that he had sort of fallen in love with the family, and he'd hoped he could convince them, because the father was blind, that maybe he could use his words, once he learned words and learned this beautiful self-expression, that maybe he could gradually introduce himself and they would accept him despite his monstrous appearance. Of course, that goes awry, which he understands. But the family, the reason they're in straits is because they helped someone, so a merchant, Turkish merchant, whose daughter is a Christian, Middle Eastern Christian, who does not speak French, is imprisoned in France for, I think they think, on trumped up charges, but they essentially conspired to have him broken out of jail, which, it, you know, I think this is during the terror. So it's, or maybe after the terror in France. So maybe this is all justified, but it's a morally ambiguous act. It's unclear. You know, the son, whose name is Felix Happiness, of course, is, engaged in this. He falls in love with the daughter by seeing her again. So Frankenstein's creature is talking about looking through this tiny crack, watching this family. The son's story is, or he gets the story that the son, was talking to his love's father, who's in jail in Paris, through a crack in like a grate. And he sees the daughter, who he then falls in love with through a heavy grate that he can't possibly even see her, right? So it's this, you're looking, it's Socrates' cave over, or Plato's cave over and over again. So anyway, they break him out of jail, and then the son goes off, but the sister and father are left behind. They get imprisoned, and then finally the Turkish guy gets away, his daughter goes off. He doesn't want his daughter in the end to marry, you know, a Christian. It's this whole crazy narrative that happens in the middle there, but it's like a little play. It's almost like how Shakespeare's plays inside the play, where you're looking at a kind of morality play about, well, what was the right decision here? You know, who created a moral decision? There's a lot of ambiguity, and everyone seems to have lost their happiness. But then, even though they're now essentially impoverished, the reentry of this woman that the son had fallen in love with, the Turkish merchant's daughter, she manages to get herself back to them and is learning French, which is why the creature then learns French, because she's being taught. And he's like this odd parallel to her at the same time he's learning as quickly as she is, and their lot is improving. Meanwhile, the creature is doing, like, you know, trivial acts for him. They're bringing him firewood to give them more leisure. He's trying to help. He's being a helpful, you know, wood elf kind of thing. So this whole thing is going on, but the family is just, you know, it's bonkers what's going on with them. And then finally, after the creature announces himself to the father's talking with them, and then the rest of the family comes back and blah, and they go off forever, and he never sees them again.
We're told by the creature that he is learning human interaction from first right. principles. Like, the first time he talks about them, he says, they seem distressed. I don't know why. And yet they are able to be happy in each other's company. And so he's actually learning about familial relationships, just like smiling at people and the fact that people laugh at each other, or the fact that people help each other, the fact that people, he's learning how to recognize all these cues about human emotion that are the cues that infants learn in the first year and a half of their life. And yet by the end of whatever, like I assume it's just a few months,
yes,
he understands enough to understand that there is a country called Turkey and that it is predominantly Islamic, but this woman was Christian, and he's able to make sense out of this morass of political, geographical facts, you know, and when he picks up Milton and starts reading it,
right,
he has a sophisticated analysis of Milton, someone who, you know, 3 months ago did not know how to speak. You know, it's an amazingly compressed idea of what language can do for you.
And I think that, again, harkens back to the notion that I don't want to retcon or headcanon what Mary Shelley was thinking, but I think you have to assume, based on that, that there's one of two things. Either the monster had some previous knowledge within him that's being unlocked. So there's some previous brain or something, right? Whatever the conception of consciousness would have been is regaining itself, but we don't know the man he was or things, people he was before. The other would be there were this idea floated around for hundreds of years before this point, there's like a thought experiment. I'm forgetting. I think maybe back to the 1600s where you're supposed to take children and isolate them in some kind of space where they would never have contact with any other person who spoke. They would only be served by silent servants, and they would learn the language of heaven, right? That's how you'd learn it, because they would just spontaneously start speaking the language that of creation. So I think there's a little bit of that notion here, because it was still, I don't know if it was still in circulation as a thing you might try, but there was this idea that, there was sort of a spontaneity, knowledge could be acquired without any presence of information in a vacuum. And he had, you know, an ample source there. But it is weird, is that the idea that he becomes this thinking deeply, I don't say moral being. I mean, he doesn't have morality as such. He has ideas of morality, but he never expresses himself in any consistent fashion towards a moral action. He doesn't, you know, it's partly because his creator is not a moral creator. Frankenstein is a weak and terrible person. And that's, that takes us back to the, is the monster invented? Like, is Frankenstein doing horrible things? I won't mention which TV show. There's a TV show that's now in its multiple season where in the first season, it's unclear who's doing some terrible things. And later you discover it's the person who's imagining this other person. It's a little bit like that, it's a common fictional thing, is you have this second self who does all the horrible stuff. And there are readings of this book where you could say that, except for that final scene, that he is projecting all this because he has a terrible moral character. And so he wants to do things. He wants to commit incest. He wants to kill his friend. He wants to remove obstacles. He wants his father to be dead so he can achieve his, you know, very Freudian, to achieve his ultimate goals. So, this family, this sort of situation in the middle with the creature developing a pseudo morality, but then so naive, thinking that he could ever be accepted. When I was reading this the other day, also, I realized I'm reading passages and I thought, oh my God, Frankenstein is a men's rights advocate. Like, he literally says things about, like, will I be denied, you know, a woman to my own, and all these things as like an object, a right, a thing he should have. And I thought, well, he's got a case to be made. He is a monstrous 8-foot, horrific, unnatural thing. And I feel terrible for him, because, you know, he will never have, normal concourse in, you know, with other people, but there are ways around that. There's the annotated version brings up the Elephant Man, for instance, as someone who was able eventually to create some place for himself. It was not a wonderful place, but that's probably the closest figure in that era that you could talk about.
It is a little bit disturbing the way he talks about women, but it is also informative that Shelley perceives that there is no state of nature for this creature. This is the other thing that's going through post-Enlightenment thought, is this, the whole concept of what is the natural state of things. You mentioned the language of heaven. There was also lots of talk about what if you took people outside of the culture in which they were born? Is there a natural way to be as a person? Frankenstein's monster is he's born literally without the possibility of community, and yet that's what he needs, is community. I think that's quite a sharp observation by Shelley at a time when I think people kind of believed the opposite. People believed that there would be some sort of a perfect state that you could be in, divorced from the world.
He is totally right. Like, he is doomed to be an outcast and alone forever, and that's terrible. But you can't say, well, he shouldn't be angry about it. Of course he should be angry. I mean, you can sympathize with the monster, but not killing people, right? That's the extent to which you say, this is kind of like the Anakin Skywalker problem. You're like, when Padma is sympathetic to him after he just killed off an entire, you know, committed genocide, there's a limit to that, limit to forgiveness, perhaps, where you have to face a consequence for your actions. And in that time, the monster, if he were a moral being, would have potentially killed himself and taken his own justice, or put himself up, like submitted, like gone to villagers and let them destroy him, or let Frankenstein kill him. But instead, he is so concerned with his own being, his incredible selfishness, that he has committed these ultimate acts, and yet refuses, like Frankenstein himself, to take responsibility for the acts he has committed that are unforgivable, and in the time, you know, are capital or fatal.
You bring up something else that came up just about a month before we started reading this book, which was the article that was quoted all over Twitter.
I have it in front of me right now. Yes.
Right, for the Sun from the UK complaining that Snowflake students claim Frankenstein's monster was misunderstood.
Oh my God, that was great.
This is a ridiculous point of view, but this is one of the things that I think is interesting about this book being taught in high school, because when you're a high school student, there is a lot of time wasted over determining who's right and who's wrong. In a narrative, the question is the monster to blame for what he did? Is Frankenstein to blame for what he did? What's the moral lesson we learn from this book? And I find that extremely tedious and boring. And I also find it completely, so utterly against the true strength of this novel. You know, the most popular view, I think, out there in about this novel, or at least about the movie that it came out of it, is that Frankenstein is the story of hubris, of a scientist who reaches beyond what man should do and tampers in God's domain. And I find that such an easy explanation for what this book is about, in the same way that I'm not particularly interested in allocating blame on either side. I think that both Frankenstein and the creature are obviously damaged individuals.
Yeah, I think you're right, is that Frankenstein is a moral actor who creates another creature that ostensibly, by all indication in the book, if we read the text, is also a moral actor and is making what we would describe in many systems of morality as bad moral decisions by his own lights, by his own reasoning and function. He does not think what he is doing is moral, and yet he continues to perform those acts, which is exactly what Frankenstein does. And you know, what's fascinating is we never hear in this novel, despite the idea that he might be, you know, tampering God's domain, you never really hear any language of that sort. There's never a thing like, I've gone against God, I have committed a sin, I've created a devil. I mean, he calls him a demon and so forth. But really, there's a great afterword in the, or a essay about the role of nature in this annotated edition by a woman who'd written another annotated version of Frankenstein. And talks about, and I think this is a very, very good point, that nature itself rebels. That everything that Frankenstein does is against nature, because the moment from when he creates the creature, his body falls apart. You know, the Frankenstein is constantly racked with illnesses. He falls into stupors for months at a time. Lightning strikes, the cataclysms, storms. Nature itself is appalled at what he did. What he did is so against the order of things, but not, there's no God. There's no, in this universe, there's nobody, there's no deity that's condemning him. It is rather the entire order of things. But then, so Frankenstein has so much hubris himself that when confronted by the monster, he's convinced by the monster, he pities him, realizes that he's wrong, that of course this creature can't live as a solitary figure. It is cruel, even though the creature has already committed horrible acts. And Frankenstein, by being unable to save Justine, who is killed, you know, by the system, has also, again, is participant in this. But that moment when he says, all right, I'll do it. And then he spends, you know, essentially quite a while, like almost, I think we're almost 2 years in or a year and a half in, creating a bride, a partner for Frankenstein. But it's only when he's almost done, he's like, wait a minute, what if they reproduced? Wait a minute, I'm creating another. He realizes suddenly, I'm creating another moral actor. This creature I create could have as much independence and strength as the first creature I created. The first creature I'm ostensibly trusting is going to go off to the Amazon or something and live there forever and never harm anybody. But this creature I create might be appalled by the first, might not love them or want to be with them, and might all go on a rampage themselves. And then what if I give them reproductive ability by accident? I don't know. It's not like he's trying to do it on purpose. I can't tell. And then they create a race of monsters that destroys humanity. Then you get into super, and that's incredible sci-fi dystopia there, right? It's like, wait, I'm about to make a race of super monsters.
Well, your emphasis upon this book's exploration of the ethics of reproduction and your comment on the way that the creation of the monster seems to have a physical effect on Frankenstein himself, it lends a lot of credence to Jill Lepore's take on this novel, which is that this is a book about the ambivalence of being a mother. And, you know, we'll step out of the text for a minute to talk a little bit about Shelley's life. She, as you mentioned,
terrible.
Her mom died shortly after she was born from complications of giving birth to her. And then she herself gave birth to a baby who died just as Percy went off to have an affair with someone else. So motherhood to Shelley was not a happy thing. And it's particularly difficult because Shelley's mother was Mary Wollstonecraft, who was one of the most important early thinkers about the rights of women in the English literature. She had to kind of contend all her life with the idea that she had somehow cut her mom's life short.
Yes.
She had to contend with this child that was unwanted by the father, born dead. You know, reproduction was not a happy thing for Mary Shelley, and it was supposed to be in the cult of womanhood of the 19th century. And let's face it, in the cult of womanhood of today, there's still a lot of people who think of the highest purpose for a woman to perform is to be a mother. And so I think there's a strong case to be made that this is a book about the ambivalence about what you feel about a creation that you don't really control or you might not really like.
It might kill you. I mean, it's a Freudian idea too, that and I think this is a corrupt one of his, is that you don't reach fulfillment as an adult until your parents are dead. You sort of have to kill your parents metaphorically or allow that to happen in order to sort of achieve a certain kind of completion. I may be oversimplifying, but it is represented that way in culture. And that's in the book too, is that his father finally, Frankenstein's father finally dies, and his mother has died long ago, and all the women in his life are dead, as are all the innocent children. There's one brother, Ernest, is still around. We all got Ernest. Don't forget about Ernest. So I think it's a really interesting reading, is that she had, I mean, at that point by 1818, she hadn't experienced all her loss. There was still a lot of loss to come, which that's why people suggest the 1831 revision reflects that, being buffeted by events that are completely out of your control. But she'd experienced plenty of loss by then. I mean, you could argue there's the flip side is that because generation is a female task. There is no way at present for someone without a uterus, a womb, to give birth, maybe someday. But, you know, in the order of things, that's the only possibility that Frankenstein, it's a cautionary tale in that sense too, that there is an order of things, that Frankenstein as a male trying to generate life, it can only generate these hideous approximations of it that are imperfect moral beings. So there's even that echo as well.
You mentioned just now, as you have before, all of the intervening personal history that came before the 1831 edition. And this is one of the reasons why a lot of people favor the 1818 edition. It's an interesting question to me because the history of literature and of film and of every art is full of these examples of revised works. And the question always becomes where you as a reader draw the line, or what you want to say is the correct one. It seems to me perfectly reasonable to look at the two editions as different works, but there was an edition of Pierre, you know, to go back to Melville.
Mm-hmm.
Pierre is a novel that a lot of people don't know by Melville, and for good reason. It's a much more difficult book to read.
Oh my God.
Than Moby Dick.
Wow.
And there was an edition that came out in the mid-90s that was illustrated by Maurice Sendak, in which the editor makes the case that Pierre was a book that went through a revision because the book itself got turned down by a publisher. And so Melville stuck a big section in the middle of the book about the ridiculousness of the publishing world in mid-19th century America. And so this other editor decided that was all not in Melville's original intent, and he took that out of that edition. And that seemed to always to me to feel kind of disingenuous, because I feel like every work of art is the product of the moment of its creation. And you have to take into account the struggles that an author has in realizing their work are part of that work. Now, on the other hand, I say that as someone who despises the special editions of Star Wars.
Rightly so.
So I don't know where I fall on this.
Right. I mean, who is the ultimate interpreter of their own work? We can get into deconstructionism now because it's 1980 right. Again. I think the 1818 and 1831 editions of this work actually stand almost as slightly different works. Even though they are largely identical, the significant changes really do have a different thematic cause, and you have to read them differently. And so as a choice in teaching this book, teaching the later version is teaching a different story. And I think that's interesting. And I give her full credit for the right and desire to do that and to revise it. It just makes it complicated. And we're, you know, given that we live at a time where we can have both editions available. And I mean, I would love, if I were a English teacher, I would love, and the students would hate me, I would love to teach both versions because, as a writing exercise, as well as a literature exercise, because it does reveal a lot just in a few choices. And I think Klinger's edition does an excellent job in doing the exegesis of that too. So you understand he makes, you know, he's not just presenting them boldly. He often puts a comment at the end and says, you can see how this emphasizes this thrust here. And it's useful because without it, you're reading these disconnected passages annotated throughout. And sometimes it's just a word here and there that's not as big a deal. And sometimes like the entire rest of the chapter, which is five pages of footnote now to show you what it's there. Yeah, I mean, is there a final text? If you look at something like Moby Dick as a text and the number of alterations and versions of it, it's mostly the same text, but there are a lot of different textual changes, not all of them approved by the author. So there's that issue of what the final text is. Here, at least we have two texts, 1818 and 1831, that are fairly intact. And we know that she was involved in the preparation and intent of those specific editions. So we know that whatever changed, she truly meant.
Well, someday on this podcast, when I can find a willing co-host, I'm going to get around to doing Walt Whitman. And that is, I think, the pinnacle of this kind of question. There was the Leaves of Grass published in 1855 and the Deathbed Edition published in
1885? No, I'm sorry. I was just researching this because, you know, Walt Whitman was a printer. And so he would go in and he would retypeset stuff himself on the bed of the printer. He'd actually would sometimes typeset things to stop himself from rewriting.
Right. It was 1892.
Oh, yes. Okay.
And there were several editions in between. But if you compare Song of Myself from the initial version to the final version, they are such completely different poems. And I read, I took a class where we had to read the 1855 edition of Leaves of Grass. And I have to admit, I think the 1855 edition of Song of Myself is the better.
This is a very brief sidebar, but I was at a rare book collection at the University of Washington looking at the November Boughs because I was looking for a font of type, which first appears in there by Whitman. And the curator was showing it to me and she said, oh, I have these books. And she pulls out these two enormous volumes that are books that detail every single edition and every variation of Whitman's work across his life. And they are ridiculous. He made so many changes. There are so many versions. And these are just bindings and printings, but they also include textual. It doesn't have all the textual notes, but it has textual or information about changes. He is possibly the most changed author in history. No one had as much involvement with the printing part, thus he was more involved in changing it. So yeah, he's the most extreme. I'm not sure. The other extreme are people who burn all their notes. They write one edition, all their notes are burned, there's nothing left but that text, and it's never revised. And that's at the other end. I have a story to tell just very briefly, though, as I was looking at this Jill Lepore piece and she opens it with how Mary Shelley led the child that died after birth. The first child was alive until the 11th day and she woke and, you know, appeared to be sleeping so quietly, I would not wake it. Then in the morning she writes, find my baby dead. And it's just, but then she writes later, this is a story that is partly, I think, contributed to the Frankenstein, is she wrote, dream that my little baby came to life again, that it had only been cold and that we rubbed it before the fire and it lived awake and find no baby. When we had our first child, my wife at one point was so sleep deprived. I think, I can't remember if I woke up or she was awake and she's searching in the bed. She's searching in the bed. She's searching in the bed. I said, what's the matter? She said, I can't find the baby. And I said, honey, it's okay. The baby's in the crib right next to you. Go. Oh, she was completely asleep. Like it was a moment of horror. I mean, I laughed at it. I told her the next morning and she was like, oh my God. But I had that sense of like, our baby is missing. And I could see the baby, but that is the true moment of horror. And I think this book encapsulates that loss, you know, and it projects it into this horrible creature. There's all of these stories about, you know, bringing people back from the other side, about bringing people back from death. And the thing that comes back is nothing you want. I mean, there's the, not Guy de Maupassant, what's the monkey paw? Is that?
Right. Is that, the monkey's paw.
Yeah. Monkey's paw. That story, you know, I wish my son alive again. You're like, don't, no. I'm just watching, I don't want to spoiler, but a modern TV series that basically had the same thing. Just the other day, an episode in which someone is brought back without their soul and is a hideous, moral monster, not awful.
Right.
This notion of the missing
pet cemetery.
Yeah, exactly. It's what a theme. But in this case, we have life created with some kind of broken soul by a broken individual who outsteps the bounds of nature. But it still is this terrible notion of a creature that is, in itself is missing something. It is never going to be part of humanity. And it is all something we apparently always fear.
Yeah, and I do see it as strongly connected to the experience of giving birth, because as you gave that example of your wife, certainly when my wife and I were having kids, both of us would have nightmares about the baby being born wrong, or the fear you have as a parent that of all the things that can go wrong, and viscerally the things that can go wrong with the body, you mm-hmm. become very aware of how fragile the human form God. Is. And that is another way that this book is so revolutionary. It's kind of the first body horror book out there.
It is so amazing. Having reread this and really studied this text for this, I was really taken by how many, I mean, I said this at the outset, but she wasn't trying to create a new genre. She wasn't trying to do any of this. She was just bloody brilliant. She's the reason for, there's so many aspects and stories that are solely because she wrote this book. And, you know, it's also, oh my God, though, reading about her, she was ridiculously prolific. There's some encyclopedia that got produced later because she had to work really hard after Percy died, and said something like she wrote 1,200 of 1,800 pages of this biographical dictionary, just one of the many things she did later in life. So she wasn't sitting around mourning. She had to work and make money, and her life was tough, and there was, she was publishing Percy, and her cousin, I think, kept cutting her off because he said he didn't want, or one of Percy's relatives would give her money if she didn't publish him, and she kept publishing Percy after his death and so forth. So this is her great work, but she produced an enormous amount of material in her life, and other parts of it are remembered as well, just not as, didn't change the world to quite the extent that this did.
Before we leave, I wanted to put in a plug for my ClickitCast co-host Phil Gonzalez, and his co-host Ali did a series on Frankenstein.
Ooh.
in their podcast entitled It's Del Toro Time, which is about the works of Guillermo del Toro, but they did a whole sequence on Frankenstein in a section on del Toro's influences, and I know they spent it's like three episodes discussing the 1818 edition. So everyone look that up. It's a lot of fun.
And I should point out this Leslie Klinger annotated Frankenstein guest who wrote the introduction, Guillermo del Toro. And it's a beautiful work in which he basically says Frankenstein is the reason that he became the man he is. No surprise, it all comes around.
Thanks to my co-host, Glenn Fleischman. You can find more about what he's up to at glennf.com. That's Glenn with two N's. The reading this week was by Moises Kahulian. Sophomore Lit is brought to you by the Incomparable Network, and this is the time of year when we remind you how you can support this podcast by becoming a member of the Incomparable. Here's what you do. Go to theincomparable.com/members and sign up. You'll then be asked to pick the shows in the network you'd like to support. If you just check the box for Sophomore Lit, your entire contribution will come to us after a few fees are taken out. If you listen to other podcasts on the Incomparable Network, and you really should, you can also check their boxes, and your contribution will be shared equally by all the shows you want to support. As a thank you for supporting us, members receive lots of extras. There's exclusive bonus audio, a bootleg podcast where you can hear episodes of shows right after they're recorded without having to wait for the edited version to arrive, and a members-only community on Slack. Since this is pledge season, many of the shows on the network will be posting bonus episodes just for members. In the case of Sophomore Lit, it's another episode of Landfill Literature, where I and a guest investigate some of the less savory books in your collection. This time, we're doing Flowers in the Attic. There are contribution levels at $5, $10, and $20 per month, and annual equivalents are available as well. And if you're already a member, it's easy to increase your pledge to a higher level and get some special goodies in return. So if you'd like to support us, go to theincomparable.com/members to sign up. Thank you, and as always, everything will be on the final.